Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
Robert, last week we talked a little bit about what had happened when Jackson full throttle invaded Florida. And the fort, which has been dubbed Negro Fort, the African fort, which contained many African Americans who had run away from slavery within it and had become a fugitive for runaway slaves. In fact, as we've talked about repeatedly throughout the time we've been doing the Florida History Podcast, Florida was actually the original place of refuge for African Americans before the Underground Railroad was created to get runaway slaves to Canada. Many escaped to Florida. We have countless podcasts on this subject. So go back in our archives if you want to learn more about that. And at the time that Jackson attacked Negro Fort, which was on the Apalachicola River, the fort was actually flying under the British Union Jack. As we've talked about on previous podcasts, the largest group of survivors from this situation, African-American survivors, runaway slave survivors, took refuge further south in a place called Angola, Florida, which is now in modern-day Manatee County. Others eventually found their way via the Saltwater Railroad, which we have a podcast on, to the Bahamas. We've covered the Negro Fort and horrible treatment of African-American runaway slaves and Seminole Native Americans in previous podcasts. I don't want to get too deep into that in this podcast, Robert. What I do want to address is that Negro Fort was flying under a Union Jack under the ostensible protection of the British. There were British officers or British soldiers in the fort. Florida was property of the Spanish, and this United States military force led by Andrew Jackson and General Gaines, who, of course, is immortalized in Tallahassee, General Edmund Gaines, with the naming of Gaines Street after him, famous part of Tallahassee, Turlington buildings on Gaines Street, as is any number of other important establishments. This was a violation of Spanish sovereignty, an attack on a British fort, in theory, and an act of naked racism and an attempt to violate all the norms of war and of international treaties. So Andrew Jackson is in trouble, you would think. At this point, there's concern in the Monroe administration, James Monroe is the president, that this is going to cause a major diplomatic row with the British and the Spanish. And none other than the Secretary of War, John C. Calhoun, who we think of as the great champion of slavery in the South and racism, in kind of a historical irony, none other than John C. Calhoun recommended the censure of General Jackson, because Calhoun, while an unbelievable racist, was also a statesman of sort. And he in terms of statecraft, he obviously a horrible person ideologically. And in time, we're going to learn he's the number one opponent of union in reality, number one destructive force in the Southern aristocracy of union and of compromise with the North, period. But at this point, Calhoun is a decade away from nullification. He's really kind of 15 years away from emerging as the greatest champion of slavery and the plantation economy. And he is concerned about Jackson. Now, ironically enough, there are people in the Congress that are disgusted with Jackson. And Henry Clay, who comes up a lot in our conversations, Robert. He's someone that was a Jeffersonian Democrat, right? He'd been the leading war hawk as Speaker of the House in 1812 to go to war with Britain. But by this time, he's already beginning to change his ideology. He's becoming much more Hamiltonian. And he is sitting in the Congress in disgust of Jackson and making this an issue in Congress. But Jackson had a defender.
Really, for the next year or so, Andrews was spreading around this state, in particularly the Panhandle, we elected another president, Monroe, famous for the Monroe Doctrine. And his mission statement to Andrew Jackson was still ambiguous, but what he wanted Jackson to occupy the whole of Florida. And the amount of power and resources that the executive gave him was astonishing. It was not at the level of, you know, Civil War army, of like Army of the Potomac, which was just massive, but it was certainly very close. It was something that the American public would not be accustomed to for another 50 years.
So, yes, Robert, I think that's something that's really fascinating to me, that you're talking about the resources that were given to Jackson to effectively conquer Florida directly by the president, James Monroe. But as I said earlier, John C. Calhoun, the Secretary of War, was not on board with this.
You saw a real frustration in the Secretary of War, John C. Calhoun, because Monroe was basically opening up an independent line of communication with Jackson, and he was sort of circumventing the War Department. And that was something that was a pretty bold thing. It was usually, for you see, the past 50 to 60 years, each department was effectively autonomous from the executive. The executive would, you know, regulate, would administrate, but for the most part, the secretary had a great deal of power. And so what you were seeing was, you were seeing what would basically carry on past Lincoln, which was an all-powerful executive who had immense power, who was not afraid to dip into all of the various cabinets and dictate policy. And so it was an interesting moment, because in many ways Jackson sort of emboldened Monroe, and I think a lot of things like the Monroe Doctrine, I think that's something that he was always a very cautious man, and I don't think he would have done it had he not been influenced by John Quincy Adams and by Andrew Jackson, who at that time wanted more than anything, wanted Spanish Florida. They wanted more territory, and they were united in that cause.
So, Robert, that's really interesting, because I think you're seeing maybe the angle of the first kind of constitutional crisis, where executive power or presidential power is exceeding that of those whose power is effectively invested in them by the president, which is executive agency, Secretary of War in this case, John C. Calhoun. Adams, as you mentioned, was Secretary of State. And I do think one of the things that's significant from my perspective is that we try and oversimplify history, right? We say, oh, well, in this kind of modern era, Calhoun was the big champion of the Southern plantation economy, of slavery. He wanted to break up the Union. This is all true, by the way. And he was a terrible, terrible guy. And I agree, he was a terrible, terrible guy. John Quincy Adams was dashing. You know, he was a person who spoke several languages. He was a diplomatic a maestro from the age of 14, right? He obviously went with his father to Paris during the War of Independence and became minister to several countries, including Russia, et cetera. And he was the most learned, cultured man, and he ended up being a big abolitionist that became the big cause of his lifetime after he was done with the presidency. So we think of Adams, we put J.Q. Adams kind of on a pedestal. But in this case of the illegal invasion of Florida, because it was the violation of Spanish sovereignty, the attacking of a fort that was under British protection, the naked racism involved in this, the naked land grab involved in this, Calhoun is on what we would consider maybe just in modern terms the more left side, the more acceptable side, and Adams is on the imperialist side, is on the side of violating another country's sovereignty. And of course, he had more diplomatic history than any American did at this point. So to me, it's really fascinating when you think about it, just in those perspectives, because we can't be guided by today, oh, you know, it's great, Florida became part of the United States. I personally think that this was a obscene venture, and it was an invasion. And it was a violation of Spain's sovereignty. We talk about the British component over and over again also. You know, you can, I think, debate that more. But in this case, Calhoun is concerned about how the Spanish and the British are going to react. And Adams really isn't. And Monroe, as you said, architect of the Monroe Doctrine, really didn't want the British or the Spanish in this hemisphere at all. I mean, Robert, the irony of John Quincy Adams being the guy who essentially sticks up for Jackson in the cabinet is confounding in many ways.
John Quincy Adams went to great lengths to protect Jackson. Following his execution of two British citizens, not military, but citizens, at St. Mark's, there were calls for Jackson to be arrested. There was one famous cabinet position in the Monroe White House cabinet meeting where that was topic number one. Were we going to arrest him? Were we going to put him on trial? And he was saved by Adams.
One of historic's greatest ironies and history's greatest ironies, Robert. And we're going to leave it there. And actually, again, Calhoun and Jackson may have been both Southerners, but they've clashed a lot, as we will find out when Jackson becomes president and Calhoun is the vice president. And it's not an irony. Calhoun was the guy leading that fight at the cabinet, saying, let's bring him back in chains. Let's arrest this guy. Because Calhoun, again, I mean, think about the Southern economy. The Southern economy already at this point is becoming very dependent on exports to Britain. So you don't want to offend the British. And the British continued to use Florida throughout Spanish rule, even though they ceded, they controlled Florida until 1784, they'd ceded Florida to the Spanish, as we've talked about before. There continued to be British influence, particularly because in European affairs, Spain and Britain were allies. Anyway, we're going to be back next week with the actual treaty, the governorship of Andrew Jackson, and some other loose ends on this series. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.